This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Mike Arnold. The residents of New Glarus will celebrate Swiss Independence Day this weekend. There's a full roster of entertainment on tap, including yodeling.
You might think of yodeling as kind of quaint, maybe a dying art, but in this Wisconsin Life piece, writer Bart Plantenga begs to differ.
Yodeling, it's a unique, powerful form of communication. The first immigrants came in the 1830s. They came from places like Switzerland and Germany and Scandinavia and settled in Wisconsin. And soon you had an active scene in the different communities, you know, merrymaking and singing. And those groups of musicians and singers, and among them some yodelers, came into contact with each other. And thus you have Scandinavians yodeling and a wild mix of folk songs. I truly like the breadth in yodeling, from total Oktoberfest insanity, where it's just one step above animal call. Pygmies in Africa yodel, among other peoples of Africa. It's used in folk songs and pop songs to religious songs. Some are convinced that God spoke to them and told them to yodel. Through Asia, I discovered the Hmong as having that same kind of technique. I mean, it sounds different in Asia because of the voices being higher, but it's used in a totally different way. I met some ladies gardening in the Choi Gardens. One woman, she said, well, I don't really yodel. And that's what the other one also said, but then went into a yodel that lasted like 10 minutes. And it was beautiful in the middle of, with no amplification or anything. And during their New Year's festival, the younger people gather and they start exchanging information about themselves. It's kind of like a dating service, but they tell it in yodeling. I like anomalies that make people reassess clichés, and I think yodeling does that on many levels because people assume certain things about it, and then when I point out a jazz yodel or in a country where it should never happen, like Japan, or a yodel in opera, people are astonished. I think there's probably room for astonishment in our world.
That was Bart Plantenga. He's the author of a couple of books about yodeling, including Yodel and Hi-Fi. And now for a look at yodeling in Wisconsin, we're joined by Jim Leary, a professor of folklore and Scandinavian studies at UW-Madison. He's also the director of the Center for the Study of Upper Midwestern Cultures. Jim, welcome to Central Time.
Glad to be here.
Well, can you give us a short history of yodeling in Wisconsin?
Well, kind of, yeah. In 1991, I published a little book called Yodeling in Dairyland, a history of Swiss music in Wisconsin, that was later described by a reviewer as a classic of fringe ethnomusicology. But in the 1840s, Swiss people came to Wisconsin, established that settlement of New Glarus, a lot of more from the canton of Glarus in Switzerland. And then in the latter decades of the 19th century, as dairying accelerated in Wisconsin, there was a real demand for cheesemakers, and a lot of Swiss people came from the canton of Bern, especially, which was a heavy yodeling area, and they came to Monroe and New Glarus, and then dispersed around, not only in southwestern Wisconsin, but in other areas, like my hometown up in Rice Lake in Barron County. There were a bunch of Swiss who came, but we know from historical accounts that, you know, as early as the 1840s, when Swiss were coming here, that they were yodelers, and did it out in the fields with their brown Swiss dairy cattle, or while milking them, but also for different different events during the year. And you know, this also attracted some of their neighbors, people from Belleville, French people from around there, or Irish would, you know, go to New Glarus and Monroe and in the 19th century and hear them yodel. And those communities in Greene County especially have kind of cultivated cultural tourism, and they've had yodel clubs for more than a century, and they've had really good yodelers who've made commercial sound recordings since at least the 1920s. They've hosted traveling performers from Switzerland, and so, you know, there's been a lot of this Swiss yodeling that's gone on. You know, then in the late 1920s, early 30s, when the kind of hillbilly performer Jimmy Rogers, known for his so-called blue yodel, began to sell a lot of records. People were influenced by that here in Wisconsin.
And Jim, can you give us a sense how popular yodeling is still in Wisconsin today?
Well, you know, I think it's somewhat isolated among the Swiss in New Glarus, but you know, there's also cowboy yodeling that you hear a little bit. I don't think it's sort of wildly popular, but it you know, it emerges now and then, and some people can't stand it. It's like you know, fingernails on a chalkboard or something. But other people like it a lot.
Do you know what the difference is between Swiss and cowboy yodeling?
Well, part of it is just I guess the style, but the two have kind of influenced each other as well, and it's a little hard to articulate, but a lot of the old classic Swiss yodeling is just, you know, there might be a little bit of accompaniment, but a lot of it is just sort of this vocal yodeling, sometimes in harmony, where you're kind of working on these vowels and, you know, working on the echoes. And the cowboy stuff is usually incorporated into songs, although the Swiss have done that as well. So that's a kind of a very simple explanation of differences.
Do you know whether young people are getting into yodeling now, or is it just the old-timers who still keep it alive?
Well, there's some young people. I don't know any, but I suspect there must be in the New Glarus and Monroe area.
Now, I don't know if you know anything about the actual mechanics of what's going on in the throat when people yodel, but as a singer myself, I've always been curious. To me, it sounds like these guys are somehow flipping through their break and singing in falsetto. Is that what it is?
Well, there's moving from chest to head singing, and then there's this kind of reverberation on vowels, and if I knew how to do it, I would do it. I've sometimes tried, but I think you have to have, it's like being double jointed or something. You know, you've got to have something in your throat that allows you to do it.
Are there any women yodelers?
Oh yeah, there's some really great ones. Down in New Glarus for many years, there was a woman named Betty Knabiel, and then she married a fellow named Vetterly, Betty Vetterly, really a great,
it's a good name,
yodeler. She started yodeling as a kid in the New Glarus area while bringing in the cows, and no one knew she did it, but she had her grandmother and her two great aunts in the early 20th century had a women's yodeling trio in that area. So yeah, lots of women have done it.
Yeah, it's so interesting. Do you have an idea about how yodelers are trying to preserve their art? You said you didn't know of any young folks doing it, so how are we keeping it alive here in Wisconsin?
Well, you know, I suspect there are younger folks who are doing it in the New Glarus area, and you know, there are people who get attracted by those kind of retro elements of country music. So you know, I think some of it's being kept alive, but I don't know enough specifics to say for sure. Certainly there are recordings out there, and I guess I could say among Hmong people who are new immigrants, there are elements of their singing in a kind of a tonal language that that has aspects that, you know, that are in fact yodeling, and they get incorporated into New Year's songs that are used at Hmong festivals. So, you know, the style of singing is not exclusive to Swiss people or people of European American heritage.
And Jim, I've always been curious. So what is the proper way to take in some yodeling? It's not really a concert setting, is it, where you sit down and watch someone? What is the appropriate setting for yodeling?
I think there are a number of situations. I mean, people have used it in everyday life while, you know, milking cows or just kind of getting excited about something. But it can happen in connection with, you know, with dance bands and festivals. I guess most of the yodeling I've heard has been at a festival or a tavern or a dance hall or something like that, and singers are kind of working it into their repertoire. Certainly there are a lot of these that happen in New Glarus, but Whoopi John, the great, you know, German band leader out of New Ulm, Minnesota, German Bohemian background, was kind of known as Whoopi because of his whoops or his yodels that he worked in. And, you know, I've heard a number of, like, Carl and the Country Dutchman, Carl Hartwick from Fountain City, Wisconsin, sometimes does these quasi-yodeling whoops that work into his exuberance while he's performing.
So it sounds like you're out at the bar, you're eating, you're drinking, you're having a good time, and someone's yodeling. That's the way it works. It sounds casual.
Yeah, and it's something that kind of pushes you over the top. You know, it turns up the gear, the fun gear, and that sort of thing.
Jim, what do you like best about yodeling?
Oh, I guess I like the kind of airy sound that it creates, and the echo, and I suppose the maybe the fact that I can't do it, but someone else can. It's also kind of humorous.
Yeah. Well, Jim, thank you so much for joining us. It's been fun to talk about yodeling.
You're welcome.
We've been talking with Jim Leary, professor of folklore and Scandinavian studies at UW-Madison. He's also the director of the Center for the Study of Upper Midwestern Cultures.
And I have to confess that, I mean, I'm of a Swiss background, so yodeling was allegedly part of I never heard anybody yodel, but when I cleaned out my grandmother's house, when she moved out of her house, I found a reel-to-reel tape that had a recording of, and it said, Uncle Adolf yodeling.
So it's in your DNA. You should be doing this, Mike.
Apparently. I probably need to work and okay. Turn the fun gear up a little bit. You're listening to Central Time here on Wisconsin Public Radio, and you know, summer's almost over.
It is August 2nd.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like we
over.
Have
a... We well, have let's a, hang well, we on have, a minute. Yeah. It's August 2nd. Let's not go almost
we
over.
We have a month, but it just feels like it's slipping
it's
away.
It's flying by, though. That's for sure.
It's slipping away. It's Friday. It's a day when you take it a little easier. So we thought it would be a little bit fun to hear what you're hoping to achieve before summer ends.
Call it your summer bucket list. What haven't you done? We all know nothing goes faster than a summer, and we're two-thirds of the way through this one, and we've got stuff to do. I don't know, Mike, some stuff on your list.
My list, I'd like to go to Door County this summer. Don't know if I'll be able to pull it off or not, but I'd like to do that. That would be something I'd like to do. So if you have something that you really feel like, man, it's not going to be summer if I don't do this, call now and let us know what that is, and we'll share different ideas. 1-800-642-1234 is the number. That's 1-800-642-1234.
Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page, of course, and just share your thoughts. What's left on your summer bucket list? 1-800-642-1234. And don't forget, you know, we're already seeing these back-to-school ads. They're out there. So summer, I guess, that's the canary in the coal mine. Summer, it's on its way out.
I mean, my son bought a backpack. So it means it's time for school, all that stuff. So before summer slips away, there are things that you want to do. I know you have those things. And if you share them with us, then it'll be fun because we'll all have a list of things that we should do over the next month before Labor Day rolls around and we're watching the telethon and regretting the fact that summer's over. So 1-800-642-1234 is, you know, the Labor Day telethon.
There's a telephone line on Labor Day.
Never mind. 1-800-642-1234 is the number. We'd love to hear from you. I'm Mike Arnold.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Mike Arnold.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time. And right now, we're taking a look at your summer to-do list. What's left on that list that you haven't done that you really intend to do this summer that will really make summer feel complete for you? One thing I wanted to do, and mine, this is not as exciting as going to Door County, which is yours, Mike. I really wanted to play tennis this summer. I thought this is the summer that I'm going to reclaim my tennis skills. I was going to rewrap my tennis racket, which kind of leaks all this black goo on my hand when I try to play tennis. I was going to rewrap it, and then I was going to play tennis, and I've done neither of those things. So that's on my list. I feel like that's still achievable, though. What about you? You can call us and tell us what your to-do list at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234.
We'll go to Sydney first. Sydney, are you there?
Sure. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a first-time caller.
Oh, great. Well, thanks for calling. So what's on your list?
Well, on my list is every year we go to Noah's Ark in Wisconsin Dells.
I pulled that one off this year, so I got one over you. Sorry. But anyway, yeah, go ahead.
It's not a competition, Mike.
That's all right. Yeah, and actually my favorite ride there is the Point of No Return, the one that goes straight down. So I like it. It's kind of a rush and sort of test my bravery there. But the other thing I'd like to do is last year we went to a hands-on art studio in Door County. And if you've never been there, it's really great. If you've never, don't feel like you have an artistic bone in your body, there's so much stuff to do. You can do fused glass. You can paint ceramics. They have metalworking. You can do lamp working. I mean, it just has everything. So, yeah.
That sounds really cool. Well, thanks for that, Sydney. I hope you can pull it off this year, and maybe some other people will, too. They'll take you as inspiration.
Excellent. Well, thanks for that call, Sydney. Let's go to Roger in Montello next. Hey, Roger.
Good afternoon.
What's on your list?
The cherries are ripe in Door County right now. You can go up and pick them. Cherries are ripe. It's a great time to go up there. Have a fish boil and a piece of fresh cherry pie.
Now that sounds about right. And that's what Mike
makes me regret not eating lunch today. I'm hungry now. That sounds great.
Yeah, that does sound pretty good. All right. Thanks, Roger. I hope you make it up there to do it. And I hope maybe you should take Mike with you. That's on your list, too.
It's like Pavlov's dog. It was kind of weird. Yeah. Anyway. Yeah.
All right. To Ann. Ann joins us in Franklin. Hi, Ann.
Hi. I used to live here, and now I live out of state. And so I come back for Irish Fest.
Irish Fest. That's a good one.
Music, great jewelry, awesome stuff. And then before I leave, I make sure I get some Cops Custard.
Oh, Cops Custard. No, I'm adding that to my list, too. I haven't had that this summer yet. That is a great one. And they also have, do you get the really flat, like hockey, well, not hockey puck, but frisbee-sized hamburgers there?
I am always dieting, but I dream about the cheeseburgers. Dream about them.
All right. Maybe you can have half one. Share it with somebody.
Yeah, there I go.
All right. Thanks so much, Ann. And so we're asking what is left on your summer to-do list. We've been sharing some of ours. Mike's fixating on Door County. I want to play some tennis. And you can call us at 1-800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And we've got producer Chris Molina here in the studio with us. So Chris, what's left on your list?
There's a lot of stuff left on my list. I, don't want to sound like I'm echoing our callers and Mike, but man, I really want to go to Door County as well. You know, it's great during this time of year. I went during the fall last year, and that was gorgeous. So I don't know if I'll get around to Door County this summer or if I'll wait until the fall, but I'll get up there at some point. But I also really want to get out on a kayak. I went kayaking for the first time in a long time last summer, and at the start of the summer, too. And I said, man, this is so much fun. You know, I want to do this all the time. And of course, that was the one time I did that during the summer. So I'm really hoping to get out on a kayak. I went canoeing a couple of weekends ago, which is great, but I feel like once you've gone kayaking, you know, you really can't go back. And it was a nice relaxing canoe ride. But, you know, I love the thrill of going kayaking. And it doesn't even have to be anywhere extreme. You know, I went down the Koshkonong Creek last time I went kayaking, which was very gentle. But it was a lot of fun. So I'm looking forward to doing that.
Excellent. I hope you make that. And I think that you, Mike, and our caller should all go to Door County together. We can have a WPR road trip.
We could play some tennis while we're there, too.
And Jake on Facebook says climbing on Devil's Lake is on his list.
That's a good idea. That's a very good idea.
Yeah, that's another good one. I don't know. That might be about all we have time for. I'm hoping that everyone gets to their list and has a fulfilling summer. Get out to Door County, people. Make it happen.
All right.
And hopefully you're going to do whatever it is you're dreaming of to make that summer complete. Put it on our Facebook page. Let us know. I'm Veronica Rickert.
I'm Mike Arnold. Coming up, we'll find out about eating bugs. Stay tuned. Central Time here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News. I'm Kristen Durst. Differing ways Wisconsin and Colorado have responded to mass shootings are being discussed at the National Governors Association meeting in Milwaukee. Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker says after the multiple killings last year in Oak Creek and Brookfield, the state worked to improve mental health services.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Mike Arnold. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's Food Friday, and we'll be speaking with a guest who believes you should start eating bugs.
Wisconsin has the highest rate of drunken driving in the country, according to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and has gotten its share of criticism for its lax policies over the years.
Well, two Republican legislators, State Representative Jim Ott and Senator Alberta Darling, have introduced a set of bills. They did that yesterday, aimed at toughening Wisconsin's drunken driving penalties. Senator Darling is joining us right now. Thanks for joining us, Senator.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for having me.
So why do you think Wisconsin needs tougher drunk driving laws right now?
Well, you just said it. We're number one in the country in binge drinking, and what we have are a lot of repeat offenders getting second, third, and fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, ninth, tenth offenses, and something's got to be done. And we're one of the few states in the country that have the fourth offense the first time that a felony will be issued. So in reality, we're saying that if you commit a OWI one, two, or three times, it's basically a misdemeanor and really just above a parking ticket, and we don't think that's the right message for a public policy for public safety.
Now, while you make this case for these tougher laws, one of the things you've been faced with is a lot of people saying, well, it's just going to be too expensive.
Yeah.
How do you respond to that?
Well, what we need to do is get into some alternative treatment models, and that will be put on the table with our other bills. What we think is that if we have tougher laws and if we let people know it is a serious offense and that Wisconsin's going to react that way and there will be consequences, and if there can be treatment along with the tougher penalties, we think that we can make great progress on lessening the number of repeat offenders, and that's what we really want to do. We want to say, look, Wisconsin is a state where public safety is extremely important, where families are extremely important, and we need to balance the scales of justice. And the victims of drunken drivers really are getting a very bad shift from the state of Wisconsin, because many of our people whose loved ones have been killed or injured have told us that they feel like, you know, their lives and their families are not as important as the offenders. So we need to balance the scales of justice. And, you know, when we talked about drunken driving laws before, Jim Ott and I have been working on this for several years, the cost comes up, but the cost of doing nothing comes up as well. When we made the fourth offense a felony, finally, a couple of years ago, we found that it did have effect on a number of incidences. So we think if we move it up to the third, we think we can have even better results. And actually, there are 25 other states that treat the third OWI as a felony. And in our neighborhood, Illinois, Iowa, and Minnesota, go as far as to say the second offense should be a felony.
So, as you work on this, you say you've been trying to do this for a while now. Do you talk to legislators in other states and try to get ideas from them on how to move it forward?
We do, and most of them will say that the cost factor is a driving obstacle, but they said by developing the will to attack the problem, what they have found that the dollar amount decreases because the offenders, the repeat offenders, are decreased. And so, yeah, at first it is a pretty big shock to the system. But if you team the tougher penalties with treatment alternatives, and we found that in our neck of the woods, Rogers Hospital has done major research in biomarker approaches, a research approach to sobriety that some of the counties are using it now, like Waukesha and Kenosha and others, have found great success with the drug courts with alternatives of treatment and with tough statutes on the books.
Now, when you talk about, you know, sort of drunk driving laws in Wisconsin, a lot of people say that it's difficult because of just the culture and actually the business of beer and alcohol in the state. Is that an issue?
Oh, definitely. But what we're saying, we're not against drinking. We are trying to do is raise consciousness and awareness of responsible drinking. And if you're impaired, then being behind the wheel of a car is not the place you should be. And I think that discussion has to be put to the people. Most people don't know that it takes to the fourth repeat offense before the state will charge a felony. Most citizens don't realize that. And so I think we have to have this conversation in our state and talk about what should our policy be, what should our attitude be, and how can we better protect our citizens who are innocently driving in most cases, but then run into a drunk driver who can, in some case, that can result in deaths, as it has for the Jenkins family in Oconomowoc. His daughter was going out for her birthday party with her daughter, and she was pregnant, and with her daughter's friends, and Paul Jenkins will say he lost half of his family because one drunken driver who was a major repeat offender ran into her and caused the three of them to die.
In working on this legislation, were you able to find any other states where it's like Wisconsin, where it has to be the fourth time before?
Yeah, there are, but 26 other states, which is, you know, more than half, have the felony at a much higher level, third or above. As I mentioned, Illinois, Iowa, and Minnesota treat the third offense as a felony, but they also treat the second as a felony.
Now, in the past, the Tavern League has been an issue with getting legislation passed?
Yeah, and I think that we don't want to get into a fight with the Tavern League because I think basically we both have the same goals. We want responsible drinking. We're not trying to say we want to end drinking. We want to cut down on people going out and having fun, going to bars and restaurants. No, what we're saying is we think that that's part of our culture, but what's missing in our culture is we have many too many people who accept being impaired, and getting behind the wheel of your car is something that is maybe at the status of a parking ticket. And that's not what most people in Wisconsin would want as a safety policy. They would not want to have us say, okay, your first, second, and third offense are like getting a parking ticket or a speeding ticket. And I don't think that's the nature of our state to say that. So we're not trying to say, let's totally change our culture. What we're saying is, you know, Wisconsin likes to party hardy, and that's all well and good. But when we party hardy, we should make sure we're not impaired when we get behind the wheel of a car, because it can be a very powerful machine that can cause great bodily harm to many people. And you're impaired if you are at twice the legal limit. And what they have, what the research tells us is when people are detained for impaired driving, that the legal alcohol level is twice that of the legal level, and that's that's a really major practice that we have to make people aware that you're really impaired when you're driving at that level. And while you don't intend to hurt anyone, accidents will happen, and those accidents have to be accounted for because we have to value the life of the victims. And many people are severely injured because of a drunken driving incident. You know, some people are even getting breathalyzers at Walgreens, which some of them are very accurate because they are concerned about their blood alcohol level. And if you're in Europe and Germany, for instance, in most bars there are breathalyzers before you leave. It's a common practice to check your blood alcohol level. And we just want to have this discussion in Wisconsin about what is responsible drinking and driving and what should the culture be in our state. And I don't think we're saying we have to change the total culture in Wisconsin, you know, to say the beer brats and having a good time have to be changed. No, we're saying we understand that that is an important part of our culture, but we also think we need to be responsible when we get behind the wheel of a car.
Well, thanks for speaking with us today, Senator Darling. We'll be covering this as it evolves.
Well, I really appreciate your interest, Mike, and I hope you can help us get the debate going because we want to involve citizens all over the state who have opinions on this matter because, in the end, it's the opinions of our citizens around the state that should prevail here.
Thank you very much. Well, that was Republican State Senator Alberta Darling of River Hills talking about her proposed legislation to toughen drunk driving penalties in Wisconsin.
Now we'll check the headlines, and then we'll take a look at an overlooked source of protein. It's Food Friday, and we're eating bugs. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Michael Arnold. This is Central Time.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Mike Arnold. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
And it's time for Food Friday. This week we're exploring a unique slice of the culinary world, to say the least. Entomophagy is the word for it, or to put that in plainer English, the consumption of insects as food.
Now, eating bugs may freak you out a little bit, but consider this. An estimated 80% of the world's population eat bugs. It's just squeamish Americans, Canadians, and Europeans who don't eat bugs.
David George Gordon is a chef and a naturalist. He's the author of the Eat a Bug Cookbook, 40 Ways to Cook Crickets, Grasshoppers, Ants, Water Bugs, Spiders, Centipedes, and Their Kin. David, welcome to Central Time.
It's great to be on your show.
Well, David, you're going to have to convince us a little here. Let's start with your story. What got you into cooking bugs?
Oh, you know, I write for a living. I like to write about fringy science stuff. And we're talking about the 1990s, I started collecting articles, mostly from science journals, about places around the world where people cook with bugs. These are like anthropology studies. Keep in mind, this is before shows like Bizarre Foods or Fear Factor or any Anthony Bourdain. So most of that information was in libraries. And I tracked a lot of that down to the point where I went, I really should be thinking about making this into a book. But so it doesn't just reach a scholarly audience, I thought a cookbook would be quite wonderful. And the book came out in 1998.
And it's a very nice-looking cookbook, actually. And, I mean, one of the points you make in the book, I guess, is that you think people should be more willing to eat bugs, right?
Yeah, and actually that's my current campaign. The book was re-released by 10 Speed Press just a month ago, so it's in a much more elegant setting. But, you know, we're basically a nation of bug bashers. Most people think bugs are gross and disgusting and germy and vile, and that's totally not true. And also, if we didn't have bugs, our planet would shut down in a matter of days.
Well, that's true. And, I mean, I think the approach you take with this cookbook, I mean, it's rather interesting to look at. There are these beautiful photographs of the food, you know, whether it's 3B salad or white chocolate and wax form cookies. Or fried green tomato hornworms, where, I mean, the bugs are very obvious. And I believe that you intentionally did that, right?
Yeah, I mentioned that in my book. And this also goes back to the original book in 98. But I wanted people to know that they were eating bugs and what they tasted like. So I didn't want to bury them in exotic garlicky sauces. And I also didn't want to grind them up and use them as an ingredient in bread or something like that. For the most part, what you're getting are the bugs staring back at you while you're eating.
Right.
You can tell what a grasshopper tastes like and how it's different from a cricket.
Now, so Mike sounds like he's kind of into this already. So, David, I'm going to ask you for my sake, I need to be convinced a little about bugs, just the squeamish factor. I admit it, I have it, and I'm not a super big bug fan, either on a plate or, you know, crawling across my picnic food. What are some nutritional reasons that we should be eating bugs and stop being grossed out by them?
Well, yeah, first of all, I have to say 80% of the world's cultures eat bugs. We happen to be in that 20% that doesn't, and we're a very vocal bunch about it. We actually start dissing people that do eat bugs, whether we know it or not. And that's something that you need to get over. I'm sorry to be direct.
Well, but the thing is...
Get over it. They're bugs.
Okay, I guess the point I'm making, though, is your cookbook has stuff that shows the bugs, which seems like that would creep people out more. And then you mentioned the Bizarre Foods show.
Yeah.
Which I mean, I think they kind of eat the bugs to creep people out. So is that doing a disservice to getting people to eat bugs if you're both creeping them out and introducing them to bugs at the same time?
I have to back up a little bit. First of all, bugs are incredibly rich in protein, pound for pound. They're about the same as lean ground beef. And they have vitamins and minerals, calcium, iron, all sorts of good stuff, and amino acids. So those are good health reasons to be eating bugs. But I want to address your second question also and say that I think in the future when people are eating bugs, they'll actually be ground up and mixed with other ingredients and be like a garden burger, let's say.
So that'll be like the sneaky chef technique you use with kids where you grind up the spinach in the Rice Krispies or something.
Yeah, exactly. There's actually a company right now called Chapul out of Salt Lake City that's making an energy bar with crickets in it. But it also has date sugar and things like that, chocolate. And I actually asked the manufacturer, well, how many crickets are in here, really? And they said 10, which is a lot.
Whoa.
But you couldn't see them. They were all processed. So people could get over their objection of, oh, this is gross. It's looking back at me. I can't eat it.
Now, but in your book, you mentioned that we are already eating bugs.
Yeah, we are, because there's actually all these FDA-approved levels of allowable limits of bugs that can be in our foods. And I'm sorry, I'm not great with numbers, but any processed food like peanut butter or jams and jellies or even chocolate will have allowable number of bugs or bug parts in it. Someone actually calculated with those allowable limits from the FDA, in a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, there can be as many as 57 bug parts.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing.
So bug appetit.
That's a lot of bugs in a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. Well, I want to ask you, I would be more inclined to eat something, and I think most people would, if it's tasty. So what is a good gateway bug, a good tasty bug when you just want to dip your toe in the pond?
You know, I'm very fond of crickets. They're easy to make. They're hard to screw up, and they're available year-round. You can go to a Petco or some large pet store that sells live food for pets. And you can buy crickets. You can even specify what size you want them. And in my book, I explain I like 4-week-old cricket nymphs because they don't have their wings yet, so they're not as crunchy as the grown-ups. What I do is I freeze them, then I defrost them. And for people who just want a gateway experience, just put them on a cookie sheet and bake them at low heat for a while and season them and serve them.
So if you get them at the pet store, though, they're alive, right?
Yeah, that's right. They're alive when you get them. You have to put the bag in the freezer. Because they're cold-blooded animals, they drift off into a deep sleep and they never wake up.
Okay, so that's humane.
Just like people in Madison, Wisconsin in the winter.
This is true. What do they taste like, though? What is the flavor?
When they're roasted like that, they have a little bit of a nutty taste. But also sort of they have a little savory taste. So let's say nuts and mushrooms.
That sounds okay. I like both those things.
One time I was in a hurry and I just microwaved some for a program, frozen ones. And without anything done to them except microwaving, they tasted very faintly of shrimp.
And that was kind of something interesting that I think you talk a little bit about crawfish and how there are some similarities between some bugs and crawfish and how it tastes. Is that right, or am I?
Yeah, a lot of the bugs taste like seafood.
Yeah,
crab or shrimp. But you know what cracks me up is that people have no problem eating lobsters and shrimp and crayfish. You know, we're used to those. Somebody said to me, "Well, they come from the ocean. Like that's supposed to make a difference." And, you know, the Pilgrims, when they landed at Plymouth Rock, they were appalled at the idea of eating lobsters. They used them to fertilize their farm fields instead.
Bugs don't really have meat on them, though, right? So where's all the nutrition coming
from?
Well,
they do have meat on them. You know, meat is basically muscle, whether it's a cow or a pig or a chicken. We like the muscle. And they have muscles in their legs. Grasshoppers, for example, have really long, strong muscles in their jumping legs. Tarantula spiders have great legs to eat. Delicious. Scorpion tails are really good. Any place where you find that muscle. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you're also eating a lot of organ meat. If you pop a cricket into your mouth, you're mostly getting what's inside the cricket.
So it seems like, you know, that where would you get your recipes? I mean, you have your book, I guess, but how did you come up with your recipes in the first place?
Oh, yeah. You know, first off, I went to a lot of these. There are a couple of large reports that are out. One published in the 50s called Insects as Human Food, which I find is a wonderful title. I'm waiting for the movie to come out.
And, I think it was a movie.
And it talked about all the different places around the world where people ate insects. So I sort of studied that and then tried to develop recipes based on what they were describing. For example, they say in Indonesia they catch dragonflies and cook them in coconut milk.
Hmm.
So I just invented my own recipe for that. And in Indonesia they call those sky prawns. Great title.
That's a great
name. I used that for my recipe in the book.
Well, David, thank you so much for joining us today. And we do have a recipe that we're posting on our Facebook page of a 3B stew of some sort. So that's going to be up there.
3B salad.
3B salad. All right, David, thank you so much. Appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me on.
That was David George Gordon, author of the Eat a Bug Cookbook.
Coming up Monday on Central Time, we'll explore the world of fantasy football, which has gone from a niche subculture to a national pastime.
We'll also take a look at the problem of overfishing and what happens when fish run out.
And also we'll talk with a guest who has some ideas on how to keep our writing shorter and more to the point in the age of Twitter and instant messaging.
That's all coming up and more on Monday on Central Time.